There's a series of loud clicks. The elevator comes to a slight pause and then begins to move laterally to the left.
It goes sideways? I ask.
Yes, there's a whole network of elevator paths under 13, he answers. This one lies just above the transport spoke to the 5th airlift platform. It's taking us to the hangar.
The hangar? The dungeons? Special defense? Somewhere food is grown, power generated, air and water purified. 13 is even larger than I thought.
Can't take credit for much of it, says Boggs. We basically inherited the place. It's been all we can do to keep it running.
The clicks resume.
We drop down again briefly, just a couple of levels, and the doors open on the hangar.
Oh!
I let out involuntarily at the sight of the fleet, row after row of different kinds of hovercraft.
Did you inherit these, too?
Some we manufactured, some were part of the Capitol's Air Force. They've been updated, of course, says Boggs. I feel that twinge of hatred against 13 again. So you had all this, and you left the rest of the districts defenseless against the Capitol?
It's not that simple. He shoots back. We were in no position to launch a counterattack until recently. We could barely stay alive. After we'd overthrown and executed the Capitol's people, only a handful of us even knew how to pilot. We could have nuked them with missiles, yes, but there's always the larger question. If we engage in that type of war with the Capitol, would there be any human life left?
That sounds like what PETA said, and you all called him a traitor, I counter.
Because he called for a ceasefire, says Boggs. You'll notice neither side has launched nuclear weapons. We're working it out the old-fashioned way. Over here, Soldier Everdeen?
He indicates one of the smaller hovercraft. I mount the stairs and find it packed with the television crew and equipment. Everyone else is dressed in 13's dark gray military jumpsuits. Even Haymitch, although he seems unhappy about the snugness of his collar. Fulvia Cardew hustles over and makes a sound of frustration when she sees my clean face.
All that work down the drain. I'm not blaming you, Katniss. It's just that very few people are born with camera-ready faces.
Like him. She snags Gale, who's in a conversation with Plutarch, and spins him toward us.
Isn't he handsome?
Gale does look striking in the uniform, I guess. But the question just embarrasses us both, given our history. I'm trying to think of a witty comeback when Boggs says brusquely,
Well, don't expect us to be too impressed. We just saw Finnick O'Dair in his underwear.
I decide to go ahead and like Boggs. There's a warning of the upcoming takeoff, and I strap myself into a seat next to Gale, facing off with Haymitch and Plutarch. We glide through a maze of tunnels that opens out onto a platform. Some sort of elevator device lifts the craft slowly up through the levels. All at once, we're outside in a large field surrounded by woods. Then we rise off the platform and become wrapped in clouds. Now that the flurry of activity leading up to this mission is over, I realize I have no idea what I'm facing on this trip to District 8. In fact, I know very little about the actual state of the war, or what it would take to win it, or what would happen if we did. Plutarch tries to lay it out in simple terms for me. First of all, every district is currently at war with the Capitol except 2, which has always had a favored relationship with our enemies despite its participation in the Hunger Games. They get more food and better living conditions. After the Dark Days and the supposed destruction of 13, District 2 became the Capitol's new center of defense, although it's publicly presented as the home of the nation's stone quarries, in the same way that 13 was known for graphite mining. District 2 not only manufactures weaponry, it trains and even supplies peacekeepers.
You mean some of the peacekeepers are born in 2? I ask.
I thought they all came from the Capitol. Plutarch nods.
That's what you're supposed to think. And some do come from the Capitol, but its population could never sustain a force that size. Then there's the problem of recruiting capital-raised citizens for a dull life of deprivation in the districts. A 20-year commitment to the peacekeepers, no marriage, no children allowed. Some buy into it for the honor of the thing, others take it on as an alternative to punishment. For instance, join the peacekeepers and your debts are forgiven. Many people are swamped in debt in the capital, but not all of them are fit for military duty. So District 2 is where we turn for additional troops. It's a way for their people to escape poverty and a life in the quarries. They're raised with a warrior mindset. You've seen how eager their children are to volunteer to be tributes.
Cato and Clove, Brutus and Enobarria. I've seen their eagerness and their bloodlust, too. But all the other districts are on our side, I ask.
Yes, our goal is to take over the districts one by one, ending with District 2, thus cutting off the capital's supply chain. Then, once it's weakened, we invade the capital itself, says Plutarch. That will be a whole other type of challenge. But we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
If we win, who would be in charge of the government? Gale asks.
Everyone, Plutarch tells him. We're going to form a republic where the people of each district and the capital can elect their own representatives to be their voice in a centralized government.
Don't look so suspicious. It's worked before.
In books, Haymitch mutters.
In history books, says Plutarch. And if our ancestors could do it, then we can too.
Frankly, our ancestors don't seem much to brag about. I mean, look at the state they left us in, with the wars and the broken planet. Clearly, they didn't care about what would happen to the people who came after them. But this republic idea sounds like an improvement over our current government.
And if we lose? I ask.
If we lose?
Plutarch looks out at the clouds, and an ironic smile twists his lips.
Then I would expect next year's Hunger Games to be quite unforgettable.
That reminds me.
He takes a vial from his vest, shakes a few deep violet pills into his hand, and holds them out to us.
We named them Nightlock in your honor, Katniss. The rebels can't afford for any of us to be captured now, but I promise it will be completely painless.
I take hold of a capsule, unsure of where to put it. Plutarch taps a spot on my shoulder at the front of my left sleeve. I examine it and find a tiny pocket that both secures and conceals the pill. Even if my hands were tied, I could lean my head forward and bite it free. Cinna, it seems, has thought of everything.
Chapter 7. The hovercraft makes a quick spiral descent onto a wide road on the outskirts of 8. Almost immediately, the door opens, the stairs slide into place, and we're spit out onto the asphalt. The moment the last person disembarks, the equipment retracts. Then the craft lifts off and vanishes. I'm left with a bodyguard made up of Gale, Boggs, and two other soldiers. The TV crew consists of a pair of burly Capitol cameramen with heavy mobile cameras encasing their bodies like insect shells. A woman director named Cressida, who has a shaved head tattooed with green vines, and her assistant, Masala, a slim young man with several sets of earrings. On careful observation, I see his tongue has been pierced too, and he wears a stud with a silver ball the size of a marble. Boggs hustles us off the road toward a row of warehouses as a second hovercraft comes in for a landing. This one brings crates of medical supplies and a crew of 6 medics. I can tell by their distinctive white outfits. We all follow Boggs down an alley that runs between 2 dull gray warehouses. Only the occasional access ladder to the roof interrupts the scarred metal walls. When we emerge onto the street, it's like we've entered another world. The wounded from this morning's bombing are being brought in. On homemade stretchers, in wheelbarrows, on carts slung across shoulders and clenched tight in arms.
bleeding, limbless, unconscious, propelled by desperate people to a warehouse with a sloppily painted H above the doorway. It's a scene from my old kitchen where my mother treated the dying, multiplied by 10, by 50, by 100. I had expected bombed-out buildings, and instead find myself confronted with broken human bodies. This is where they plan on filming me? I turn to Boggs. This won't work, I say. I won't be good here. He must see the panic in my eyes, because he stops a moment and places his hands on my shoulders.
You will. Just let them see you. That will do more for them than any doctor in the world could.
A woman directing the incoming patients catches sight of us, does a sort of double take, and then strides over. Her dark brown eyes are puffy with fatigue, and she smells of metal and sweat. A bandage around her throat needed changing about 3 days ago. The strap of the automatic weapon slung across her back digs into her neck, and she shifts her shoulder to reposition it. With a jerk of her thumb, she orders the medics into the warehouse. They comply without question.
"This is Commander Paler of 8, says Boggs. "Commander, Soldier Katniss Everdeen."
She looks young to be a commander, early 30s, but there's an authoritative tone to her voice that makes you feel her appointment wasn't arbitrary. Beside her, in my spanking new outfit, scrubbed and shiny, I feel like a recently hatched chick, untested, and only just learning how to navigate the world.
"Yeah, I know who she is," says Paler. "You're alive, then. We weren't sure."
Am I wrong, or is there a note of accusation in her voice?
"I'm still not sure myself," I answer. "Been in recovery," Boggs taps his head. "Bad concussion."
He lowers his voice a moment.
"Miscarriage. But she insisted on coming by to see you're wounded." "Well, we've got plenty of those," says Paler. "You think this is a good idea?" says Gale, frowning at the hospital. "Assembling your wounded like this?"
"I don't. Any sort of contagious disease would spread through this place like wildfire."
"I think it's slightly better than leaving them to die," says Paler. "That's not what I meant," Gale tells her.
"Well, currently that's my other option. But if you come up with a third and get coin to back it, I'm all ears." Paler waves me toward the door.
"Come on in, Mockingjay. And by all means, bring your friends."
I glance back at the freak show that is my crew, steel myself, and follow her into the hospital. Some sort of heavy industrial curtain hangs the length of the building, forming a sizable corridor. Corpses lie side by side, curtain brushing their heads, white cloths concealing their faces.
"We've got a mass grave started a few blocks west of here, but I can't spare the manpower to move them yet," says Paler.
She finds a slit in the curtain and opens it wide. My fingers wrap around Gale's wrist.
"Do not leave my side," I say under my breath. "I'm right here," he answers quietly.
I step through the curtain and my senses are assaulted. My first impulse is to cover my nose to block out the stench of soiled linen, putrefying flesh and vomit, all ripening in the heat of the warehouse. They've propped open skylights that crisscross the high metal roof, but any air that manages to get in can't make a dent in the fog below. The thin shafts of sunlight provide the only illumination, and as my eyes adjust, I can make out row upon row of wounded, in cots, on pallets, on the floor, because there are so many to claim the space. The drone of black flies, the moaning of people in pain, and the sobs of their attending loved ones have combined into a wrenching chorus. We have no real hospitals in the districts. We die at home, which at the moment seems a far desirable alternative to what lies in front of me. Then I remember that many of these people probably lost their homes in the bombings. Sweat begins to run down my back, fill my palms. I breathe through my mouth in an attempt to diminish the smell. Black spots swim across my field of vision, and I think there's a really good chance I could faint. But then I catch sight of Paler, who's watching me so closely, waiting to see what I am made of, and if any of them have been right to think they can count on me. So I let go of Gale, and force myself to move deeper into the warehouse, to walk into the narrow strip between two rows of beds. "Katniss!" a voice croaks out from my left, breaking apart from the general din. "Katniss!" A hand reaches for me out of the haze. I cling to it for support. Attached to the hand is a young woman with an injured leg. Blood has seeped through the heavy bandages, which are crawling with flies. Her face reflects her pain, but something else, too, something that seems completely incongruous with her situation. "Is it really you?"
"Yeah, it's me," I get out. Joy. That's the expression on her face. At the sound of my voice, it brightens, erases the suffering momentarily.
"You're alive! We didn't know. People said you were, but we didn't know," she says excitedly.
"I got pretty banged up, but I got better," I say, "just like you will."
"I've got to tell my brother."
The woman struggles to sit up and calls to someone a few beds down.
"Eddie! Eddie! She's here! It's Katniss Everdeen!"
A boy, probably about 12 years old, turns to us. Bandages obscure half of his face. The side of his mouth I can see opens as if to utter an exclamation. I go to him, push his damp brown curls back from his forehead, murmur a greeting. He can't speak, but his one good eye fixes on me with such intensity, as if he's trying to memorize every detail of my face. I hear my name rippling through the hot air, spreading out into the hospital.
"Katniss! Katniss Everdeen!"
The sounds of pain and grief begin to recede, to be replaced by words of anticipation. From all sides, voices beckon me. I begin to move, clasping the hands extended to me, touching the sound parts of those unable to move their limbs, saying, "Hello, how are you? Good to meet you." Nothing of importance, no amazing words of inspiration, but it doesn't matter. Boggs is right. It's the sight of me, alive, that is the inspiration. Hungry fingers devour me, wanting to feel my flesh. As a stricken man clutches my face between his hands, I send a silent thank you to Dalton for suggesting I wash off the makeup. How ridiculous, how perverse I would feel presenting that painted capital mask to these people. The damage, the fatigue, the imperfections, that's how they recognize me, why I belong to them. Despite his controversial interview with Caesar, many ask about Peter, assure me that they know he was speaking under duress. I do my best to sound positive about our future, but people are truly devastated when they learn I've lost the baby. I want to come clean and tell one weeping woman that it was all a hoax, a move in the game. But to present Peter as a liar now would not help his image, or mine, or the cause. I begin to fully understand the lengths to which people have gone to protect me, what I mean to the rebels, my ongoing struggle against the capital, which has so often felt like a solitary journey, has not been undertaken alone. I have had thousands upon thousands of people from the districts at my side. I was their mockingjay long before I accepted the role. A new sensation begins to germinate inside me, but it takes until I am standing on a table, waving my final goodbyes to the hoarse chanting of my name to define it. Power. I have a kind of power I never knew I possessed. Snow knew it as soon as I held out those berries. Plutarch knew when he rescued me from the arena. And Coin knows now. So much so that she must publicly remind her people that I am not in control. When we're outside again, I lean against the warehouse, catching my breath, accepting the canteen of water from Boggs.
"You did great," he says.
Well, I didn't faint or throw up or run out screaming. Mostly I just rode the wave of emotion rolling through the place.
"We got some nice stuff in there," says Cressida.
I look at the insect cameramen, perspiration pouring from under their equipment. Masala scribbling notes. I had forgotten they were even filming me.
"I didn't do much, really," I say.
"You have to give yourself some credit for what you've done in the past," says Boggs.
What I've done in the past? I think of the trail of destruction in my wake. My knees weaken, and I slide down to a sitting position.
That's a mixed bag.
"Well, you're not perfect by a long shot, but times being what they are, you'll have to do," says Boggs.
Gale squats down beside me, shaking his head.
"I can't believe you let all those people touch you. I kept expecting you to make a break for the door."
"Shut up," I say with a laugh.
"Your mother's going to be very proud when she sees the footage," he says.
"My mother won't even notice me. She'll be too appalled by the conditions in there." I turn to Boggs and ask, "Is it like this in every district?"
"Yes. Most are under attack. We're trying to get in aid wherever we can, but it's not enough."
He stops a minute, distracted by something in his earpiece. I realize I haven't heard Haymitch's voice once, and fiddle with mine, wondering if it's broken.
"We're to get to the airship immediately,"
Boggs says, lifting me to my feet with one hand.
"There's a problem."
"What kind of problem?" asks Gale.
"Incoming bombers," says Boggs.
He reaches behind my neck and yanks Cinna's helmet up onto my head.
"Let's move."
Unsure of what's going on, I take off running along the front of the warehouse, heading for the alley that leads to the airstrip. But I don't sense any immediate threat. The sky's an empty, cloudless blue. The street's clear except for the people hauling the wounded to the hospital. There's no enemy, no alarm. Then the sirens begin to wail. Within seconds, a low-flying V-shaped formation of Capitol hoverplanes appears above us, and the bombs begin to fall. I'm blown off my feet, into the front wall of the warehouse. There's a searing pain just above the back of my right knee. Something has struck my back as well, but it doesn't seem to have penetrated my vest. I try to get up, but Boggs pushes me back down, shielding my body with his own. The ground ripples under me as bomb after bomb drops from the planes and detonates. It's a horrifying sensation being pinned against the wall as the bombs rain down. What was that expression my father used for easy kills? Like shooting fish in a barrel. We are the fish, the street the barrel.
"Katniss!"
I'm startled by Haymitch's voice in my ear.
"What?
Yes, what?
I'm here,"
I answer.
"Listen to me. We can't land during the bombing, but it's imperative you're not spotted," he says.
"So they don't know I'm here?" I assumed, as usual, it was my presence that brought on punishment.
"Intelligence thinks no, that this raid was already scheduled," says Haymitch.
Now Plutarch's voice comes up, calm but forceful, the voice of a head game maker used to calling the shots under pressure.
"There's a light blue warehouse 3 down from you. It has a bunker in the far north corner. Can you get there?"
"We'll do our best," says Boggs. Plutarch must be in everyone's ear because my bodyguards and crew are getting up.
My eye instinctively searches for Gale and sees he's on his feet, apparently unharmed.
"You've got maybe 45 seconds to the next wave," says Plutarch.
I give a grunt of pain as my right leg takes the weight of my body, but I keep moving. No time to examine the injury. Better not to look now anyway. Fortunately, I have on shoes that Cinna designed. They grip the asphalt on contact and spring free of it on release. I'd be hopeless in that ill-fitting pair that 13 assigned to me. Boggs has the lead, but no one else passes me. Instead, they match my pace, protecting my sides, my back. I force myself into a sprint as the seconds tick away. We pass the second gray warehouse and run along a dirt-brown building. Up ahead, I see a faded blue facade.
Home of the Bunker. We have just reached another alley, need only to cross it to arrive at the door when the next wave of bombs begins. I instinctively dive into the alley and roll toward the blue wall. This time it's Gale, who throws himself over me to provide one more layer of protection from the bombing. It seems to go on longer this time, but we are farther away. I shift onto my side and find myself looking directly into Gale's eyes. For an instant the world recedes, and there is just his flushed face, his pulse visible at his temple, his lips slightly parted as he tries to catch his breath.
"You all right?"
he asks, his words nearly drowned out by an explosion.
"Yeah, I don't think they've seen me," I answer. "I mean, they're not following us."
"No, they've targeted something else," says Gale.
"I know, but there's nothing back there, but..."
The realization hits us at the same time.
"The hospital."
Instantly, Gale's up and shouting to the others.
"They're targeting the hospital."
"Not your problem," says Plutarch firmly. "Get to the bunker."
"But there's nothing there but the wounded," I say.
"Katniss?"
I hear the warning note in Haymitch's voice and know what's coming.
"Don't even think about..."
I yank the earpiece free and let it hang from its wire. With that distraction gone, I hear another sound, machine gun fire coming from the roof of the dirt-brown warehouse across the alley. Someone is returning fire. Before anyone can stop me, I make a dash for an access ladder and begin to scale it, climbing, one of the things I do best.
"Don't stop,"
I hear Gale say behind me. Then there's the sound of his boot on someone's face. If it belongs to Boggs, Gale's going to pay for it dearly later on. I make the roof and drag myself onto the tar. I stop long enough to pull Gale up beside me, and then we take off for the row of machine gun nests on the street side of the warehouse. Each looks to be manned by a few rebels. We skid into a nest with a pair of soldiers, hunching down behind the barrier.
"Boggs, know you're up here?"
To my left, I see Paler behind one of the guns, looking at us quizzically. I try to be evasive without flat-out lying.
"He knows where we are, all right."
Paler laughs.
"I bet he does. You've been trained in these?"
She slaps the stock of her gun.
"I have in 13, says Gale, "but I'd rather use my own weapons."
"Yes, we've got our bows." I hold mine up, then realize how decorative it must seem. "It's more deadly than it looks."
"It would have to be," says Paler. "All right, we expect at least 3 more waves. They have to drop their sight shields before they release the bombs. That's our chance. Stay low."
I position myself to shoot from one knee.
"Better start with fire," says Gale.
I nod and pull an arrow from my right sheath. If we miss our targets, these arrows will land somewhere, probably the warehouses across the street. A fire can be put out, but the damage an explosive can do may be irreparable. Suddenly, they appear in the sky, 2 blocks down, maybe 100 yards above us, 7 small bombers in a V formation.
"Geese!"
I yell at Gale. He'll know exactly what I mean. During migration season, when we hunt fowl, we've developed a system of dividing the birds so we don't both target the same ones. I get the far side of the V, Gale takes the near, and we alternate shots at the front bird. There's no time for further discussion. I estimate the lead time on the hover planes and let my arrow fly. I catch the inside wing of one, causing it to burst into flames. Gale just misses the point plane. A fire blooms on an empty warehouse roof across from us. He swears under his breath. The hover plane I hit swerves out of formation, but still releases its bombs. It doesn't disappear, though. Neither does one other I assume was hit by gunfire. The damage must prevent the sight shield from reactivating.
"Good shot," says Gale.
"I wasn't even aiming for that one," I mutter. I'd set my sights on the plane in front of it. "They're much faster than we think."
"Positions!"
Paler shouts. The next wave of hover planes is appearing already.
"Fire's no good," Gale says.
I nod
and we both load explosive-tipped arrows. Those warehouses across the way look deserted anyway. As the planes sweep silently in, I make another decision. "I'm standing," I shout to Gale and rise to my feet. This is the position I get the best accuracy from. I lead earlier and score a direct hit on the point plane, blasting a hole in its belly. Gale blows the tail off a second. It flips and crashes into the street, setting off a series of explosions as its cargo goes off. Without warning, a third V formation unveils. This time, Gale squarely hits the point plane. I take the wing off the second bomber, causing it to spin into the one behind it. Together they collide into the roof on the warehouse across from the hospital. A fourth goes down from gunfire. "All right, that's it," Paler says. Flames and heavy black smoke from the wreckage obscure our view. "Did they hit the hospital?"
"Must have," she says grimly.
As I hurry toward the ladders at the far end of the warehouse, the sight of Masala and one of the insects emerging from behind an air duct surprises me. I thought they'd still be hunkered down in the alley.
"They're growing on me," says Gale.
I scramble down a ladder. When my feet hit the ground, I find a bodyguard, Cressida, and the other insect waiting. I expect resistance, but Cressida just waves me toward the hospital. She's yelling, "I don't care, Plutarch. Just give me 5 more minutes. Not one to question a free pass, I take off into the street.
"Oh, no,"
I whisper as I catch sight of the hospital. What used to be the hospital. I move past the wounded, past the burning plane wrecks, fixated on the disaster ahead of me. People screaming, running about frantically, but unable to help. The bombs have collapsed the hospital roof and set the building on fire, effectively trapping the patients within. A group of rescuers has assembled, trying to clear a path to the inside. But I already know what they will find. If the crushing debris and the flames didn't get them, the smoke did. Gale's at my shoulder. The fact that he does nothing only confirms my suspicions. Miners don't abandon an accident until it's hopeless.
"Come on, Katniss. Haymitch says they can get a hovercraft in for us now," he tells me.
But I can't seem to move. Why would they do that? Why would they target people who were already dying? I ask him.
"Scare others off. Prevent the wounded from seeking help," says Gale. "Those people you met, they were expendable. To Snow, anyway. If the capital wins, what will they do with a bunch of damaged slaves?"
I remember all those years in the woods, listening to Gale rant against the capital. Me, not paying close attention, wondering why he even bothered to dissect its motives. Why thinking like our enemy would ever matter? Clearly, it could have mattered today. When Gale questioned the existence of the hospital, he was not thinking of disease, but this, because he never underestimates the cruelty of those we face. I slowly turn my back to the hospital and find Cressida, flanked by the insects, standing a couple of yards in front of me, her manners unrattled, cool even.
"Katniss," she says, "President Snow just had them air the bombing live. Then he made an appearance to say that this was his way of sending a message to the rebels. What about you? Would you like to tell the rebels anything?"
"Yes," I whisper. The red blinking light on one of the cameras catches my eye. I know I'm being recorded.
"Yes," I say more forcefully. Everyone is drawing away from me, Gale, Cressida, the insects, giving me the stage. But I stay focused on the red light. "I want to tell the rebels that I am alive, that I'm right here in District 8, where the Capitol has just bombed a hospital full of unarmed men, women, and children. There will be no survivors."
The shock I've been feeling begins to give way to fury.
"I want to tell people that if you think for 1 second the Capitol will treat us fairly if there's a ceasefire, you're deluding yourself, because you know who they are and what they do."
My hands go out automatically, as if to indicate the whole horror around me.
"This is what they do,
And we must fight back.
I'm moving in toward the camera now, carried forward by my rage. President Snow says he's sending us a message. Well, I have one for him. You can torture us and bomb us and burn our districts to the ground. But do you see that? One of the cameras follows as I point to the planes burning on the roof of the warehouse across from us. The Capitol seal on the wing glows clearly through the flames. Fire is catching! I am shouting now, determined that he will not miss a word. And if we burn, you burn with us! My last words hang in the air. I feel suspended in time, held aloft in a cloud of heat that generates not from my surroundings, but from my own being. Cut! Cressida's voice snaps me back to reality, extinguishes me. She gives me a nod of approval. That's a wrap. Chapter 8. Boggs appears and gets a firm lock on my arm, but I'm not planning on running now. I look over at the hospital, just in time to see the rest of the structure give way, and the fight goes out of me. All those people, the hundreds of wounded, the relatives, the medics from 13, are no more. I turn back to Boggs, see the swelling on his face left by Gale's boot. I'm no expert, but I'm pretty sure his nose is broken. His voice is more resigned than angry, though. Back to the landing strip. I obediently take a step forward and wince as I become aware of the pain behind my right knee. The adrenaline rush that overrode the sensation has passed, and my body parts join in a chorus of complaints. I'm banged up and bloody, and someone seems to be hammering on my left temple from inside my skull. Boggs quickly examines my face, then scoops me up and jogs for the runway. Halfway there, I puke on his bulletproof vest. It's hard to tell because he's short of breath, but I think he sighs. A small hovercraft, different from the one that transported us here, waits on the runway. The second my team's on board, we take off. No comfy seats and windows this time. We seem to be in some sort of cargo craft. Boggs does emergency first aid on people to hold them until we get back to 13. I want to take off my vest, since I got a fair amount of vomit on it as well, but it's too cold to think about it. I lie on the floor with my head in Gale's lap. The last thing I remember is Boggs spreading a couple of burlap sacks over me. When I wake up, I'm warm and patched up in my old bed in the hospital. My mother's there, checking my vital signs. How do you feel? A little beat up, but all right, I say. No one even told us you were going until you were gone, she says. I feel a pang of guilt. When your families had to send you off twice to the Hunger Games, this isn't the kind of detail you should overlook. I'm sorry. They weren't expecting the attack. I was just supposed to be visiting the patients, I explain. Next time, I'll have them clear it with you. Katniss, no one clears anything with me, she says. It's true. Even I don't. Not since my father died. Why pretend? Well, I'll have them notify you anyway. On the bedside table is a piece of shrapnel they removed from my leg. The doctors are more concerned with the damage my brain might have suffered from the explosions, since my concussion hadn't fully healed to begin with. But I don't have double vision or anything, and I can think clearly enough. I've slept right through the late afternoon and night, and I'm starving. My breakfast is disappointingly small, just a few cubes of bread soaking in warm milk. I've been called down to an early morning meeting at command. I start to get up and then realize they plan to roll my hospital bed directly there. I want to walk, but that's out, so I negotiate my way into a wheelchair. I feel fine, really, except for my head and my leg and the soreness from the bruises and the nausea that hit a couple minutes after I ate. Maybe the wheelchair's a good idea. As they wheel me down, I begin to get uneasy about what I will face. Gale and I directly disobeyed orders yesterday, and Boggs has the injury to prove it. Surely there will be repercussions, but will they go so far as coin annulling our agreement for the victor's immunity? Have I stripped PETA of what little protection I could give him? When I get to command, the only ones who've arrived are Cressida, Messala, and the insects. Messala beams and says, "There's our little star!" And the others are smiling so genuinely that I can't help but smile in return. They impressed me in 8, following me onto the roof during the bombing, making Plutarch back off so they could get the footage they wanted. They more than do their work. They take pride in it, like Cinna. I have a strange thought that if we were in the arena together, I would pick them as allies, Cressida, Messala, and... I have to stop calling you the insects, I blurt out to the cameramen. I explain how I didn't know their names, but their suits suggested the shelled creatures. The comparison doesn't seem to bother them. Even without the camera shells, they strongly resemble each other. Same sandy hair, red beards, and blue eyes. The one with close-bitten nails introduces himself as Castor, and the other, who's his brother, as Pollux. I wait for Pollux to say hello, but he just nods. At first I think he's shy or a man of few words, but something tugs on me, the position of his lips, the extra effort he takes to swallow, and I know before Castor tells me, Pollux is an Avox. They have cut out his tongue and he will never speak again. And I no longer have to wonder what made him risk everything to help bring down the capital. As the room fills, I brace myself for a less congenial reception. But the only people who register any kind of negativity are Haymitch, who's always out of sorts, and a sour-faced Fulvia Cardew. Boggs wears a flesh-colored plastic mask from his upper lip to his brow. I was right about the broken nose. So his expression's hard to read. Coin and Gale are in the midst of some exchange that seems positively chummy. When Gale slides into the seat next to my wheelchair, I say, "Making new friends?" His eyes flicker to the president and back. "Well, one of us has to be accessible." He touches my temple gently. "How do you feel?" They must have served stewed garlic and squash for the breakfast vegetable. The more people who gather, the stronger the fumes are. My stomach turns, and the lights suddenly seem too bright. "Kind of rocky," I say. "How are you?" "Fine. They dug out a couple of pieces of shrapnel. No big deal," he says. Coin calls the meeting to order. "Our airtime assault has officially launched. For any of you who missed yesterday's 20-hundred broadcast of our first propo, or the 17 reruns Beatty has managed to air since, we will begin by replaying it." Replaying it? So they not only got usable footage, they've already slapped together a propo and aired it repeatedly? My palms grow moist in anticipation of seeing myself on television. What if I'm still awful? What if I'm as stiff and pointless as I was in the studio, and they've just given up on getting anything better? Individual screens slide up from the table. The lights dim slightly, and a hush falls over the room. At first, my screen is black. Then a tiny spark flickers in the center. It blossoms, spreads, silently eating up the blackness until the entire frame is ablaze with a fire so real and intense, I imagine I feel the heat emanating from it. The image of my Mockingjay pin emerges, glowing red gold. The deep, resonant voice that haunts my dreams begins to speak. Claudius Templesmith, the official announcer of the Hunger Games, says, "Katniss Everdeen, the girl who was on fire, burns on!" Suddenly there I am, replacing the Mockingjay, standing before the real flames and smoke of District 8. I want to tell the rebels that I am alive, that I'm right here in District 8, where the Capitol has just bombed a hospital full of unarmed men, women, and children. There will be no survivors. Cut to the hospital collapsing in on itself with the desperation of the onlookers as I continue in voiceover. I want to tell people that if you think for 1 second the Capitol will treat us fairly, if there's a ceasefire,
You're deluding yourself, because you know who they are and what they do.
Back to me now, my hands lifting up to indicate the outrage around me.
This is what they do, and we must fight back.
Now comes a truly fantastic montage of the battle. The initial bombs falling, us running, being blown to the ground. A close-up on my wound, which looks good and bloody. Scaling the roof, diving into the nests, and then some amazing shots of the rebels, Gale, and mostly me, knocking those planes out of the sky. Smash cut back to me, moving in on the camera. President Snow says he's sending us a message. Well, I have one for him. You can torture us and bomb us and burn our districts to the ground. But do you see that? We're with the camera, tracking to the planes burning on the roof of the warehouse, tight on the Capitol seal on a wing, which melts back into the image of my face, shouting at the president, "Fire is catching, and if we burn, you burn with us." Flames engulf the screen again. Superimposed on them in black, solid letters are the words, "If we burn, you burn with us." The words catch fire and the whole screen burns to blackness. There's a moment of silent relish, then applause followed by demands to see it again. Coin indulgently hits the replay button, and this time, since I know what will happen, I try to pretend that I'm watching this on my television at home in the seam. An anti-capital statement. There's never been anything like it on television, not in my lifetime anyway. By the time the screen burns to black a second time, I need to know more. Did it play all over Panem? Did they see it in the Capitol?
Not in the Capitol, says Plutarch. We couldn't override their system, although BD's working on it. But in all the districts, we even got it on in two, which may be more valuable than the Capitol at this point in the game.
Is Claudius Temple-Smith with us? I ask. This gives Plutarch a good laugh.
Only his voice. But that's ours for the taking. We didn't even have to do any special editing. He said that actual line in your first games.
He slaps his hand on the table.
What say we give another round of applause to Cressida, her amazing team, and of course, our on-camera talent?
I clap, too, until I realize I'm the on-camera talent, and maybe it's obnoxious that I'm applauding for myself, but no one's paying attention. I can't help noticing the strain on Fulvia's face, though. I think how hard this must be for her, watching Haymitch's idea succeed under Cressida's direction, when Fulvia's studio approach was such a flop. Coin seems to have reached the end of her tolerance for self-congratulation.
Yes, well deserved. The result is more than we had hoped for. But I do have to question the wide margin of risk that you were willing to operate within. I know the raid was unforeseen. However, given the circumstances, I think we should discuss the decision to send Katniss into actual combat.
The decision? To send me into combat? Then she doesn't know that I flagrantly disregarded orders, ripped out my earpiece, and gave my bodyguards the slip? What else have they kept from her?
It was a tough call, says Plutarch, furrowing his brow, but the general consensus was that we weren't going to get anything worth using if we locked her in a bunker somewhere every time a gun went off. And you're all right with that? Asks the president.
Gale has to kick me under the table before I realize that she's talking to me.
Oh, yeah, I'm completely all right with that. It felt good, doing something for a change. Well, let's be just a little more judicious with her exposure, especially now that the Capitol knows what she can do, says Coin. There's a rumble of assent from around the table.
No one has ratted out Gale and me, not Plutarch, whose authority we ignored, not Boggs, with his broken nose, not the insects we led into fire, not Haymitch. No. Wait a minute. Haymitch is giving me a deadly smile and saying sweetly,
"Yeah, we wouldn't want to lose our little mockingjay when she's finally begun to sing."
I make a note to myself not to end up alone in a room with him, because he's clearly having vengeful thoughts over that stupid earpiece.
"So, what else do you have planned?" asks the president.
Plutarch nods to Cressida, who consults a clipboard.
We have some terrific footage of Katniss at the hospital in 8. There should be another propo in that with the theme, because you know who they are and what they do. We'll focus on Katniss interacting with the patients, particularly the children, the bombing of the hospital, and the wreckage. Masala's cutting that together. We're also thinking about a Mockingjay piece. Highlight some of Katniss's best moments, intercut with scenes of rebel uprisings and war footage. We call that one Fire is Catching. And then Fulvia came up with a really brilliant idea. Fulvia's mouthful of sour grapes expression is startled right off her face, but she recovers. Well, I don't know how brilliant it is, but I was thinking we could do a series of propos called We Remember, and each one we would feature one of the dead tributes. Little Rue from 11, or old Mags from 4. The idea being that we could target each district with a very personal piece.
A tribute to your tributes, as it were, says Plutarch.
That is brilliant, Fulvia, I say sincerely. It's the perfect way to remind people why they're fighting.
I think it could work, she says. I thought we might use Finnick to intro and narrate the spots, if there was interest in them.
Frankly, I don't see how we could have too many We Remember propos, says Coyne. Can you start producing them today?
Of course, says Fulvia, obviously mollified by the response to her idea.
Cressida has smoothed everything over in the creative department with her gesture, praised Fulvia for what is, in fact, a really good idea, and cleared the way to continue her own on-air depiction of the Mockingjay. What's interesting is that Plutarch seems to have no need to share in the credit. All he wants is for the airtime assault to work. I remember that Plutarch is a head game maker, not a member of the crew, not a piece in the games. Therefore, his worth is not defined by a single element, but by the overall success of the production. If we win the war, that's when Plutarch will take his bow and expect his reward. The president sends everyone off to get to work, so Gail wheels me back to the hospital. We laugh a little about the cover-up. Gail says no one wanted to look bad by admitting they couldn't control us. I'm kinder, saying they probably didn't want to jeopardize the chance of taking us out again now that they've gotten some decent footage. Both things are probably true. Gail has to go meet Beatty down in special weaponry, so I doze off. It seems like I've only shut my eyes for a few minutes, but when I open them, I flinch at the sight of Haymitch sitting a couple of feet from my bed, waiting, possibly for several hours, if the clock is right. I think about hollering for a witness, but I'm going to have to face him sooner or later. Haymitch leans forward and dangles something on a thin white wire in front of my nose. It's hard to focus on, but I'm pretty sure what it is. He drops it to the sheets.
That is your earpiece.
I will give you exactly one more chance to wear it. If you remove it from your ear again, I'll have you fitted with this. He holds up some sort of metal headgear that I instantly name the head shackle. It's an alternative audio unit that locks around your skull and under your chin until it's opened with a key. And I'll have the only key. If for some reason you're clever enough to disable it. Haymitch dumps the head shackle on the bed and whips out a tiny silver chip. I'll authorize them to surgically implant this transmitter into your ear so that I may speak to you 24 hours a day. Haymitch in my head full time, horrifying. I'll keep the earpiece in, I mutter.
Excuse me,
he says. I'll keep the earpiece in, I say, loud enough to wake up half the hospital.
You sure?
Because I'm equally happy with any of the three options, he tells me. I'm sure, I say. I scrunch up the earpiece wire protectively in my fist and fling the head shackle back in his face with my free hand, but he catches it easily. Probably was expecting me to throw it. Anything else? Haymitch rises to go. While I was waiting, I ate your lunch.
My eyes take in the empty stew bowl and tray on my bed table.
"I'm going to report you," I mumble into my pillow.
"You do that, sweetheart."
He goes out, safe in the knowledge that I'm not the reporting kind. I want to go back to sleep, but I'm restless. Images from yesterday begin to flood into the present. The bombing, the fiery plane crashes, the faces of the wounded who no longer exist. I imagine death from all sides. The last moment before seeing a shell hit the ground, feeling the wing blown from my plane and the dizzying nosedive into oblivion. The warehouse roof falling down at me while I'm pinned helplessly to my cot. Things I saw, in person or on the tape. Things I caused with a pull of my bowstring. Things I will never be able to erase from my memory. At dinner, Finnick brings his tray to my bed so we can watch the newest propo together on television. He was assigned quarters on my old floor, but he has so many mental relapses, he still basically lives in the hospital. The rebel's heir, the because you know who they are and what they do propo, that Masala edited. The footage is intercut with short studio clips of Gale, Boggs, and Cressida describing the incident. It's hard to watch my reception in the hospital in 8, since I know what's coming. When the bombs rain down on the roof, I bury my face in my pillow, looking up again at a brief clip of me at the end, after all the victims are dead. At least Finnick doesn't applaud or act all happy when it's done. He just says, "People should know that happened, and now they do." "Let's turn it off, Finnick, before they run it again," I urge him. But as Finnick's hand moves toward the remote control, I cry, "Wait! The Capitol is introducing a special segment, and something about it looks familiar. Yes, it's Caesar Flickerman, and I can guess who his guest will be." PETA's physical transformation shocks me. The healthy, clear-eyed boy I saw a few days ago has lost at least 15 pounds and developed a nervous tremor in his hands. They've still got him groomed, but underneath the paint that cannot cover the bags under his eyes and the fine clothes that cannot conceal the pain he feels when he moves is a person badly damaged. My mind reels, trying to make sense of it. I just saw him, 4, no, 5, I think it was 5 days ago. How has he deteriorated so rapidly? What could they possibly have done to him in such a short time? Then it hits me. I replay in my mind as much as I can of his first interview with Caesar, searching for anything that would place it in time. There is nothing. They could have taped that interview a day or two after I blew up the arena, then done whatever they wanted to do to him ever since. "Oh, PETA," I whisper. Caesar and PETA have a few empty exchanges before Caesar asks him about rumors that I'm taping propos for the districts.
"They're using her, obviously," says PETA, "to whip up the rebels. I doubt she even really knows what's going on in the war, what's at stake, what the risks are to her personally. They're probably hoping she gets knocked off so they can turn her into some kind of martyr."
"Is there anything you'd like to tell her?" asks Caesar.
"There is," says PETA. He looks directly into the camera, right into my eyes. "Don't be a fool, Katniss. Think for yourself. They've turned you into a weapon that could be instrumental in the destruction of humanity. If you've got any real influence, use it to put the brakes on this thing. Use it to stop the war before it's too late. Ask yourself, do you really trust the people you're working with? Do you really know what's going on? And if you don't, find out." Black screen. Seal of Panem. Show over. Finnick presses the button on the remote that kills the power. In a minute, people will be here to do damage control on PETA's condition and the words that came out of his mouth. I will need to repudiate them, but the truth is, I don't trust the rebels, or Plutarch, or Coin. I'm not confident that they tell me the truth. I won't be able to conceal this. Footsteps are approaching. Finnick grips me hard by the arms.
"We didn't see it."
"What?" I ask.
We didn't see Peter, only the propo on 8. Then we turned the set off because the images upset you. Got it?
He asks. I nod.
Finish your dinner.
I pull myself together enough so that when Plutarch and Fulvia enter, I have a mouthful of bread and cabbage. Finnick is talking about how well Gale came across on camera. We congratulate them on the propo. Make it clear it was so powerful, we tuned out right afterward. They look relieved. They believe us. No one mentions Peter.
Chapter 9. I stop trying to sleep after my first few attempts are interrupted by unspeakable nightmares. After that, I just lie still and do fake breathing whenever someone checks on me. In the morning, I'm released from the hospital and instructed to take it easy. Cressida asks me to record a few lines for a new Mockingjay propo. At lunch, I keep waiting for people to bring up Peeta's appearance, but no one does. Someone must have seen it besides Finnick and me. I have training, but Gale's scheduled to work with Beatty on weapons or something, so I get permission to take Finnick to the woods. We wander around a while, and then ditch our communicators under a bush. When we're a safe distance away, we sit and discuss Peeta's broadcast.
I haven't heard one word about it. No one's told you anything? Finnick says.
I shake my head. He pauses before he asks,
Not even Gale?
I'm clinging to a shred of hope that Gale honestly knows nothing about Peeta's message, but I have a bad feeling he does.
Maybe he's trying to find a time to tell you privately.
Maybe, I say. We stay silent so long that a buck wanders into range. I take it down with an arrow. Finnick hauls it back to the fence.
For dinner, there's minced venison in the stew.
Gale walks me back to compartment E after we eat. When I ask him what's been going on, again there's no mention of Peeta. As soon as my mother and sister are asleep, I slip the pearl from the drawer and spend a second sleepless night clutching it in my hand, replaying Peeta's words in my head.
Ask yourself, do you really trust the people you're working with? Do you really know what's going on? And if you don't, find out.
Find out? What? From who? And how can Peeta know anything except what the Capitol tells him? It's just a Capitol propo. More noise. But if Plutarch thinks it's just the Capitol line, why didn't he tell me about it? Why hasn't anyone let me or Finnick know?
Under this debate lies the real source of my distress. Peeta. What have they done to him? And what are they doing to him right now? Clearly Snow did not buy the story that Peeta and I knew nothing about the rebellion, and his suspicions have been reinforced now that I have come out as the Mockingjay. Peeta can only guess about the rebel tactics, or make up things to tell his torturers. Lies, once discovered, would be severely punished. How abandoned by me he must feel. In his first interview, he tried to protect me from the Capitol and rebels alike, and not only have I failed to protect him, I've brought down more horrors upon him. Come morning, I stick my forearm in the wall and stare groggily at the day's schedule. Immediately after breakfast, I am slated for production. In the dining hall, as I down my hot grain and milk and mushy beets, I spot a communicuff on Gale's wrist.
When did you get that back, Soldier Hawthorne? I ask.
Yesterday. They thought if I'm going to be in the field with you, it could be a backup system of communication, says Gale.
No one has ever offered me a communicuff. I wonder if I asked for one, would I get it?
Well, I guess one of us has to be accessible, I say with an edge to my voice. What's that mean? He says.
Nothing. Just repeating what you said, I tell him, and I totally agree that the accessible one should be you. I just hope I still have access to you as well.
Our eyes lock, and I realize how furious I am with Gale. That I don't believe for a second that he didn't see Peeta's propo, that I feel completely betrayed that he didn't tell me about it. We know each other too well for him not to read my mood and guess what has caused it.
Katniss, he begins, Already the admission of guilt is in his tone. I grab my tray, cross to the deposit area, and slam the dishes onto the rack. By the time I'm in the hallway, he's caught up with me.
"Why didn't you say something?"
he asks, taking my arm. "Why didn't I?" I jerk my arm free. "Why didn't you, Gale? And I did, by the way, when I asked you last night about what had been going on."
"I'm sorry, all right? I didn't know what to do. I wanted to tell you, but everyone was afraid that seeing Peter's proper would make you sick," he says.
"They were right. It did. But not quite as sick as you lying to me for coin." At that moment, his communicuff starts beeping. "There she is. Better run. You have things to tell her." For a moment, real hurt registers on his face. Then cold anger replaces it. He turns on his heel and goes. Maybe I've been too spiteful, not given him enough time to explain. Maybe everyone is just trying to protect me by lying to me. I don't care. I'm sick of people lying to me for my own good. Because really, it's mostly for their own good. Lie to Katniss about the rebellion so she doesn't do anything crazy. Send her into the arena without a clue so we can fish her out. Don't tell her about Peeta's propo because it might make her sick, and it's hard enough to get a decent performance out of her as it is. I do feel sick, heartsick, and too tired for a day of production. But I'm already at remake, so I go in. Today, I discover, we will be returning to District 12. Cressida wants to do unscripted interviews with Gale and me, throwing light on our demolished city.
"If you're both up for that," says Cressida, looking closely at my face.
"Count me in," I say. I stand, uncommunicative and stiff, a mannequin, as my prep team dresses me, does my hair, and dabs makeup on my face. Not enough to show, only enough to take the edge off the circles under my sleepless eyes. Boggs escorts me down to the hangar, but we don't talk beyond a preliminary greeting. I'm grateful to be spared another exchange about my disobedience in 8, especially since his mask looks so uncomfortable. At the last moment, I remember to send a message to my mother about my leaving 13, and stress that it won't be dangerous. We board a hovercraft for the short ride to 12, and I'm directed to a seat at a table where Plutarch, Gale, and Cressida are poring over a map. Plutarch's brimming with satisfaction as he shows me the before and after effects of the first couple of propos. The rebels, who were barely maintaining a foothold in several districts, have rallied. They have actually taken 3 and 11, the latter so crucial since it's Panem's main food supplier, and have made inroads in several other districts as well.
"Hopeful, very hopeful indeed," says Plutarch. "Fulvia's going to have the first round of We Remember spots ready tonight, so we can target the individual districts with their dead. Finnick's absolutely marvelous."
"It's painful to watch, actually," says Cressida. "He knew so many of them personally."
"That's what makes it so effective," says Plutarch, "straight from the heart. You're all doing beautifully. Coin could not be more pleased."
Gale didn't tell them, then, about my pretending not to see Peter and my anger at their cover-up. But I guess it's too little too late, because I still can't let it go. It doesn't matter. He's not speaking to me, either. It's not until we land in the meadow that I realize Haymitch isn't among our company. When I ask Plutarch about his absence, he shakes his head and says,
"He couldn't face it."
"Haymitch? Not able to face something?"
"Wanted a day off, more likely," I say. I think his actual words were, "I couldn't face it without a bottle," says Plutarch.
I roll my eyes, long out of patience with my mentor, his weakness for drink, and what he can or can't confront. But about 5 minutes after my return to 12, I'm wishing I had a bottle myself. I thought I'd come to terms with 12's demise, heard of it, seen it from the air, and wandered through its ashes. So why does everything bring on a fresh pang of grief?
Was I simply too out of it before to fully register the loss of my world? Or is it the look on Gale's face as he takes in the destruction on foot that makes the atrocity feel brand new? Cressida directs the team to start with me at my old house. I ask her what she wants me to do. "Whatever you feel like," she says. Standing back in my kitchen, I don't feel like doing anything. In fact, I find myself focusing up at the sky, the only roof left, because too many memories are drowning me. After a while, Cressida says, "That's fine, Katniss. Let's move on." Gale doesn't get off so easily at his old address. Cressida films him in silence for a few minutes, but just as he pulls the one remnant of his previous life from the ashes, a twisted metal poker, she starts to question him about his family, his job, life in the seam. She makes him go back to the night of the firebombing and reenact it, starting at his house, working his way down across the meadow and through the woods to the lake. I straggle behind the film crew and the bodyguards, feeling their presence to be a violation of my beloved woods. This is a private place, a sanctuary already corrupted by the capital's evil. Even after we've left behind the charred stumps near the fence, we're still tripping over decomposing bodies. Do we have to record it for everyone to see? By the time we reach the lake, Gale seems to have lost his ability to speak. Everyone's dripping in sweat, especially Castor and Pollux in their insect shells, and Cressida calls for a break. I scoop up handfuls of water from the lake, wishing I could dive in and surface alone and naked and unobserved. I wander around the perimeter for a while. When I come back around to the little concrete house beside the lake, I pause in the doorway and see Gale propping the crooked poker he salvaged against the wall by the hearth. For a moment, I have an image of a lone stranger, somewhere far in the future, wandering lost in the wilderness and coming upon this small place of refuge, with the pile of split logs, the hearth, the poker, wondering how it came to be. Gale turns and meets my eyes, and I know he's thinking about our last meeting here, when we fought over whether or not to run away. If we had, would District 12 still be there?